Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 44. "Welcome home, General," said Semyaza. "We delivered some casualties," said West flatly, as he began descending the steel steps leading from the mezzanine offices to the granite floor of the NORAD Command Center. "Do you feel better now?" asked Semyaza smoothly. "I'm used to dynamic battlefields," said Wes, unfolding his hands from behind his back as he came to a stop in front of Semyaza's 12-foot frame. "There comes a point when less is more, don't you think?" inquired Semyaza, testing Wes. "I'm not a politician. I'm a warrior," said Wes. "Oh, come now, General. Politics is just the mechanics of religion. And religions are what make the best warriors," said Semyaza, unable to help himself. "You should know. We wouldn't even have religions if it wasn't for you," said Wes. "It was not my genius alone," said Semyaza. "What would genocide be without them?" asked Wes. "Pointless," said Semyaza quickly. "And don't get me started on bankers," said Wes. "Now, that was my genius. The concept of wealth is the greatest of all religions. Nothing makes a man more insane than gold. And when he gets it, he thinks he owns everyone around him," said Semyaza. "The only thing he owns is the fear that someone will take it from him," said Wes. "Spectacular, is it not?" said Semyaza, rubbing his giant white furry hands together as he played along with the general's harmless game. "You've been doing the same thing for so long you don't even know when you're losing," said Wes. "Your mortal perspective is becoming annoying," said Semyaza. "There are several hundred million souls escaping with what rightfully belongs to us," said Wes, raising his voice and pointing at Semyaza. "There are billions here on this world, and they all serve the Dark Prince now," said Semyaza. "You swerved into that reward through the slavery of debt and the slime of propaganda. The people never had a chance," said Wes. "They had hundreds of chances, and they chose the solid world we gave them," said Semyaza. "You're saying they took a risk, but it is you who took the risk," said Wes. "Risk is all about choice, my good general," said Semyaza, placating. "Strategy is all about giving choices, like any other game. You just have to make damn sure you own all the choices," said Wes. "Mortal life is not some carnival midway where every choice is wrong and even the winners are worthless. There has to be an upside, or no one will play. They will just stay on the other side. Without pleasure, what is the value in pain? Without exaltation, who would risk damnation?" asked Semyaza coldly. "Damnation? Don't play that game with me. The entire concept of hell was created by you to empower your religions, which, I might add, were not catching on so well until you did," said Wes. "This is about light and the absence of light. The universe and all its light came from darkness, and it will return to it. And we will be waiting for all of them when they arrive," said Semyaza. "Again you miscalculate," said Wes, turning to pace in front of Semyaza. "I see a thousand moves ahead, mortal," said Semyaza, furrowing his human face toward his piercing blue eyes to stare at Wes. "A thousand circles are not a thousand moves," said Wes, countering him. "The universe is finite, limited by the resolution with which it is observed," said Semyaza. "Although that is true, my master, your assumption has made you weak and limited," said Wes. "Usually it is I who do the tempting," said Semyaza, warning Wes that he was risking being torn in half while still alive. "Copying a sandcastle is a little difficult when you have to figure out, first, how to create your own sand, don't you think? Asked Wes. He paused for a moment to watch Semyaza face the weakness of his oversight, and then he walked slowly back up the steps and disappeared down to the left toward his perfectly kept apartment. How do those boots feel? Asked Dick. Not too bad, as long as I don't try to walk, said Shelley. I don't suppose you have those low-top boots, do you? Asked Dick. We have chukka boots, if that's what you mean. By the way, I thought the wedding was amazing. She's pretty good, isn't she? Said the young female corporal. I know it doesn't sound much like it was the best tux I've ever seen, but it was, said Dick. The tux was good, but the wedding dress was nothing short of spectacular, said Katie. We should have brought the album, but we didn't, so could we get the chukka boots instead? Asked Dick, trying not to push too hard. No problem. I'll be right back, said the corporal. Dick, that was mean, said Katie, poking him in the ribs with her elbow. Sorry, but it's race day, said Dick, shrugging it off. Nice one, bro, said Orphan. It's my fault. I just know I would be nothing but a bleeding blister in 2 miles in those boots, said Shelley. Maybe we won't have to walk so far, said Orphan. Yeah, I heard Riker say that they were boosting everything that will roll or fly. There are 3,000 people down here, you know, said Dick. You guys don't have to go out today, but I do. We do, said Orphan, correcting himself. You got pizza coming? Asked Dick. My father is coming, said Orphan. He has a feeling. I'm with him, said Shelley. Here you go. Try these on, and here's some socks to go with them. I think you'll like these better, said the corporal. Shelley dusted off the chair and sat down to pull on the socks and the boots. She laced them up and stood up, wiggling her hips a little from side to side. Much better. At least they're not so stiff, said Shelley. You're the best. Thank you so much, said Katie. Okay, one more run down Batcave Highway, said Dick, clapping his hands together. Yeah, let's go. You ready? Asked Orphan. Lead the way, said Shelley as she waved goodbye to the corporal behind the counter. The Challenger rumbled to life with the rich smell of alcohol getting past the twin turbochargers. Within a couple of minutes, they could see the Gate A doors ahead, and Dick backed off the throttle and brought the car to a stop with the dust still settling behind them. Hey, you guys are not going to believe this, but radiation is falling off by the minute. I just checked it. It's down to less than 250 out there. Something has to be absorbing it or something. This should take days. You know what I mean? Asked Kyle. Not really, buddy, said Dick. No, he's right. Radioactive decay is fixed in the universe. Haven't you ever heard of an atomic clock? The rate at which excess neutrons come off of the nucleus is set in stone. It's textbook stuff, said Donna, trying to match Kyle's excitement. I'm a gearhead. What does that mean in car and driver speak? Asked Dick as he leaned up against the control counter and wrapped his arms around Katie from behind. Too many questions and not enough answers, said Kyle. The planet is accelerating, which means we're bending space-time. But what could be doing that? I mean, the planet doesn't have a rocket engine attached to it, and it's still light outside, even though we're probably not even in orbit around the sun anymore, said Kyle as fast as he could. Okay, breathe. You can breathe now, said Dick, smiling at Kyle. Let's open the door, said Orphan. Hold on, everyone, said Frank, gripping the wheel around the curve. Slow down, Frank, said Lucy, trying to get seated in the bus seat above him. I got it, Mama. I was distracted, said Frank, pointing up toward the sun visor into the dark sky. That's them. They're attacking, said JJ. Stop the bus, Frank. Over there. Get up against the mountain. There, said Abdullah. He's right. They're dropping bombs up ahead, said JJ. How far up ahead? Asked Frank, slowing the bus to a stop and setting the air brake with the sheer face of the mountain next to the concrete barricade at the end of the freeway. Our flight plan called for a zone between Pennsylvania and Maryland, said JJ. Mother of God! Everyone will be killed, said Abdullah. Close your eyes, everyone. Don't look at the flashes, said JJ. Cover your eyes, Lucy, yelled Frank as he buried his face in his arms over the steering wheel. The first flash was silent, but he felt the heat from the light on his long-sleeved arms. Like lightning too far away for thunder, the explosions lashed, shockwaves that leveled or burned everything in the way like a cosmic Sith. One flash stripped the branches and leaves from the trees, and the next burned the trunk to the dirt like a cigarette ash. Debris started falling onto the roof of the bus as it ran off the top of the mountain like it was running from the annihilation. At first, it was small twigs bouncing off the roof and then across the freeway, not so sheltered from the high-velocity winds. Bits of gravel and then rocks the size of baseballs pounded the insulated roof of the bus. Suddenly, the crack of a bomb just a few miles away split the sky and shattered the glass on one side of the bus and the windshield. Lucy screamed. "Get down, Mama! Hang on!" yelled Frank over the rumbling. The smell of cinders and ozone burned Abdullah's nose as he coughed and dug his feet under his seat in hopes of not being swept away with the shock waves. He felt his heart beating quickly and the pain of gripping the back of the seat in front of him as the bus shook from side to side like a plane being tossed by a thunderstorm at 50,000 feet. He doubted it, but for a moment he thought the bus had been blown 1,000 feet into the air and it was falling to be crushed when it struck the ground. He thought about the totes of used transmission fluid and whether it would burst into flame and burn them all alive. He thought about dying, but he didn't want to burn. How much hatred was in a man who could attack innocent people from space? He remembered the recent years when wave after wave of American drones pounded the cities and villages in the Middle East, launched from ships floating 100 miles away. Some of his former co-workers and villagers suffered terrible burns and injuries during the horrible days of Obama's secret war against Christians. More than 500,000 unarmed people died, and trying to shoot back was hopeless. No news organization would report what was happening, although hundreds of appeals went to the United Nations about it. This attack was much worse than that. This was not a battle. This was an extermination. Just when he thought surely he would be driven insane with the flashes of light like a strobe light, with drums beating so loudly that it drove the air from his lungs, he felt the pressure easing. He took a breath. The concussion from the last explosion was a little softer. The flashes began to slow. The wheels of the bus seemed to be on the asphalt at the edge of the freeway. Somehow, the mountain of West Virginia protected them from the shock waves. But the air seemed to still be on fire somewhere far away. Like a tornado that had touched down during a forest fire, the ashes danced and swirled around the ravine that contained the freeway. "Abdullah, are you okay?" asked JJ, crawling on his belly down the aisle of the bus. "God was willing today. I will live another day," said Abdullah. "Frank, are you still with us?" shouted JJ as he made his way toward the front of the bus. "Yeah, I'm here. I think I'm bleeding, but not too bad," said Wes. "Oh, Frank, JJ, bring me one of those diapers back there," yelled Lucy as she slid down the steps to the driver's cockpit. "Be careful, Lucy. There's glass everywhere," said Frank, holding his hand over his left arm that was bleeding through his fingers. "Let me see. Is there still glass in there? JJ, bring a couple bottles of water and get the jar of pink eye powder from the first aid kit," yelled Lucy as she washed the dirt and ash from the lacerations on his forearm. "They're not that deep. Just elevated for an hour or so." "Here you go, ma'am. Pampers, water, pink eye powder," said JJ. "Best field bandage ever," said Lucy, pouring half a bottle of water over Frank's arm to wash out the dust that had blown through the open front windshield. "YouTube?" asked JJ. "Desert Storm," said Lucy. "Ah, okay. Pink eye powder?" asked Frank with his hands shaking. topical antibiotic. Well, you're done driving, mister, said Lewis. I can drive, said J.J. Good. Let's get moving. They may need our help, said Abdullah. Okay, let's do this. The best I can tell, the closest they got to us was about 30 miles on the other side of this mountain. The flashes were about 25 seconds ahead of the sound, said J.J.
30 miles? It sounded like it was right in my lap, said Frank.
No, sir. If that was the case, we wouldn't be here, said J.J., turning the key and letting the diesel engine kick to life.
How far do we have to go to get to Side R? Asked Abdullah.
I think we were about 120 miles or so, best I can remember, before the world got blown to shit, said Frank.
Well, take it slow. We don't know what condition the roads are in, but hurry up, said Abdullah, managing a smile.
Maybe we should wait for the others, said Katie. We don't have to go out right now, not if you don't want to. But I got a crazy kind of urge to find a place, said Dick.
What place? Asked Katie, focusing her eyes on his.
No one moved. There was always some software running deep inside of Dick Daring. He never announced what he was going to do. He just did it. He would walk a racetrack for hours, around and around before a race. Every crack, every low place was logged into his soul, and when he played it back at 200 miles an hour, he knew exactly what to do.
Our son is going to be born in this certain place. I couldn't find it on a map, but I'll know it when I see it, said Dick slowly and softly. He brushed her long hair back from her face and kissed her on the cheek.
We got a full tank? Asked Katie.
And then some. When you run out, you can just make some more, said Kyle, fist-bumping Dick.
Sounds like biotic fuel, said Dick.
Better living through fermentation, I always say, said Kyle.
What time is it? Asked Shelley.
You've been living in a cave. What do you mean, what time is it? Asked Orphan.
I don't know what I mean, said Shelley. I'm opening the door. There's nothing to be afraid of.
Come on, said Orphan, holding his hand out for her as he moved from the station office to the steel man door leading outside.
The bolt moved surprisingly easy in the door as Orphan slid the 1-inch thick steel bar out of its jam. Everyone held their breath while he pulled the door to the inside of the cavernous facility. The air smelled of ozone, but was remarkably clean and absent of smoke. The gravel was left under the once asphalt road, but there was nothing on the hills or mountains surrounding them. Not a pine tree or a bush could be seen for miles all the way to the ridge surrounding them. The green granite of Raven Rock was exposed here and there, where the force of the blasts pushed back the dirt, but there were no craters to be seen. It was then that Dick looked up into the marmalade sky above them.
Whoa! We're not in Kansas anymore, he said, pointing up.
So that's what the Earth looks like, said Donna.
On the outside, the planet we're on now fit into all the spaces inside that world.
Like the professor said, said Kyle.
Does it look a little gray, or is that just me? Asked Donna.
Can you say cadaver? Said Dick.
Yeah, it looks like the world did back in the 50s, said Katie.
Newsreel city, said Kyle.
So what happens to people on that world when they die? Asked Shelley.
The same thing that happens to the ones on this world, said Orphan.
So, you're telling me that is some sort of black-and-white prison planet? Asked Shelley.
Well, it looks like our escape was planned a long time ago. I'm glad they didn't wipe us out, said Dick.
Wow, I guess this is why the ancients built their cities from granite.
Not so primitive after all, said Kyle.
Let's see if we can get the main door open. I feel like taking a drive under the Sirius Earthlight, said Dick, smiling.
He and Kyle went back inside, and the heavy mechanical sound of a chain being pulled around a pulley could be heard as the 2-ton blast door began to swing on its massive hinge pins.
That's a tribute to government spending for you. Nothing but the best for the good old USA, courtesy of the American taxpayer, said Kyle as the door moved smoothly to the fully open position. You coming with us? Asked Dick, after they recovered their breath from working to open the door manually. Actually, Donna and I thought about hanging with the president for a while. He kind of asked me to head up his Department of New Energy, said Kyle, with his lower lip shaking. Hey, you don't need an older brother anymore, but I'll always be here, said Dick, putting his hand on Kyle's shoulder. I never would have made it, began Kyle, as he shook Dick's hand firmly. I always knew you were going to change the world, said Dick. It kind of changed without my help, said Kyle. Oh, see, that's where you're wrong. None of this world would have been possible without you. I would have been a grease monkey working in the pits the last few years if it wasn't for you. That's the truth. That's the way I see it, said Dick. Katie and Donna walked up together to join them. Secretary of Energy, huh? Said Katie. New energy. We're done burning up the planet, said Kyle, smiling. I'm going to miss you, sister, said Donna, hugging Katie. I have a feeling we're all going to grow old together, said Donna. Very old, said Dick, hugging Donna. Well, we're off, said Dick. Oh, I have something for you, said Kyle, retrieving his book bag from the office. He laid it carefully on the ground and unzipped the center section. From it, he pulled a dark brown plastic quart jar and handed it to Dick. What is it? Asked Dick. It's the breeder stock for your fuel. Just pour it into the tank of water, and it will convert in about 2 hours to the fuel you're running on now. Oh, and make sure to refill the jar when it's done, so you can make more. If you accidentally let those critters out, don't worry. They only last a few minutes in sunlight, said Kyle, smiling and pulling his hair back out of his eyes. No pollution, right? Asked Katie. No way. Just carbon dioxide and water. Good for the garden, actually, said Kyle. What a world, said Dick. Yeah, baby, said Kyle, fist-bumping Dick. Well, we're going to see if we can get a pizza somewhere, said Dick. Hey, when you find it, the garden, send a postcard, said Kyle. I'll be back. I only have one little brother, said Dick, hugging Kyle and patting him on the back. They watched the purple Challenger rumble down the gravel road toward the horizon until it disappeared. Donna put her arm around Kyle's waist and kissed him on the cheek. They turned to look around in the quiet surrounding area. A bird flew overhead and landed on the ground near them. It searched the ground for something to eat and then took off for the next mountain ridge a few miles away. The air was barely moving, smelling a little like a swimming pool with the ozone in the air. Turbos are going to love this air, said Kyle at last. Huh? Said Donna. Ozone. Three oxygen atoms together. Free radicals. Makes for hellacious horsepower, said Kyle. Hey, I think they're coming back. I hear something, said Shelley, pointing back down the gravel mountain road. That's not the Challenger. That sounds like a diesel, said Kyle. The roof of what was left of an old tour bus began to show over the horizon. The muffler was gone, so the four-cylinder turbo diesel was loud and laboring along the gravel road. The windshield was gone, and a man in military garb could be seen fighting the wheel to steer the bus along the uneven surface. Blue smoke followed as it came closer and closer. Is that transmission fluid I smell? Asked Kyle. That, my friends, is my father, said Orphan. The bus lumbered to a stop a few yards away, and the air brake spat its air into the dust beneath the frame. The door squeaked open, and Abdullah stepped out onto the gravel. There is a God. I knew it. I knew it, said Abdullah, holding out his arms to wrap around Orphan and Shelley as they both rushed to meet him. I didn't believe it when he told me. I thought you were in L.A., said Shelley. Many things changed my mind, my daughter, said Abdullah. What? You adopted her and didn't tell me? Asked Orphan, kidding with his father. No, my son. You did, said Abdullah. How did you know? Asked Shelley. They wanted you dead. You had to live. It was a simple thing to send the joy of my life to protect you. It is the way God works, you know, said Abdullah. Dad, I'm not the same, said Orphan. Oh, but you are. We get distracted by the things of this world. Now you remember who you are. It was your love that opened the gate for you. Thank you, my Shelley. Thank you more than I can ever repay, said Abdullah, hugging her again. There are others, said Orphan. Yes, I suppose there are those who want to make this journey. It will be long and full of challenges, but then many say that is the true heaven, said Abdullah. Yeah, I know, but there are others on the bus, said Orphan finally. Oh, yes, yes. You remember my super secretary, Lucy. This is her husband, Frank. Don't shake his hand. He has an injury. And these gentlemen are some of the pilots that commanded the ships that nearly killed you all. This is JJ, and this is Will, and the rest of these guys we picked up half dead along the way. This particular airman said he was on the command plane on the other world running the whole battle. You see, my dear Shelley, your voice saved many souls, said Abdullah. Hello, my dear. It's good to see you again, said Lucy, shaking her hand firmly. Are you all that's left? Asked Frank. Oh, gosh, no. There's a whole town in there. The president and a couple thousand staffers and a hell of a chef named Bailey. Are you guys hungry? Asked Shelley, smiling and holding on to Orphan's hand. We better see if we can find Smith or Jones or somebody. They probably need to know what we know, said Orphan. I'm on it. Let me see if I can make something work with the phone system, said Kyle as he and Donna walked back into the Gate A station office. You see, the challenges have begun already, said Abdullah, rubbing his hands together and smiling broadly at Orphan. The Beginning.